This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. and we rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available on podcast. Simply go to your podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There's now more ways to stay in touch with DC 37. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, keep a lookout for the union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. That's for DC 37 members, obviously. If you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's one word, stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. We have a very special guest with us this evening. He is a well-known political strategist who has been a regular pundit on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and other outlets. He was a senior aide to Hillary Clinton during her first campaign for Senate. He is now a distinguished lecturer of politics and public policy at the City University of New York's Murphy Institute. He is Basil Smichel Jr., and welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, and thank you very much.
Let's talk a little bit about this position at CUNY. This is something you've just started?
It's something, yes. I was appointed this semester to be this distinguished lecturer, which is sort of an amazing progression just in my political life, in the sense that I started my career at 1199 and the National Benefit Fund back in 1994.
Time flies, Basil. Time flies.
It does indeed. And, you know, I even got my bachelor's from Cornell in labor relations. So I end up teaching in this Institute for Labor and Worker Education, Labor Studies and Worker Education. And I often teach a lot of union members who are going back to school for certificates, bachelor's, and yes, even master's degrees. So it's just a great opportunity to sort of continue this part, this aspect of my life, which is, I think, a dedication to organized labor.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you're someone who, just looking at your resume, your CV, someone who clearly, through labor, in politics, you have a belief that politics can get things done. And
Absolutely.
I wanted to have a conversation, if you don't mind, for the next few minutes about what your take is on the state of the conversation and what the shape of politics is in the country in 2018. So if that's not enough of a lead-in, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I actually will answer this question based on a question I had from one of my students in the in Murphy Institute in the spring semester of 2017. So this is just after Donald Trump is sworn in.
Yes.
And it's after his first few executive orders. A question came to me, which I thought was it was sad on the one hand and profound on the other. It was, can the president really do that? And speaking of these executive orders, and I said, yes, that's what being president is. And unfortunately, it's now that people who didn't pay that much attention to the process, and indeed didn't necessarily understand the role of politics, the connection between politics and policy, people are really starting to understand that there is this incredible connection between politics and governance, that the people that you elect are imbued with certain powers and responsibilities, and we are responsible for holding them accountable for the work that we do. And we sort of throw that word around a lot. We know that people that are elected are supposed to work for us, but do we really understand the powers that they have in the roles that we elect them to, serve in? Do we really understand those powers? And I think if we understood that more, we would take more time to make our decision whether to vote for person X over person Y, or even just to come out and vote in it just overall. If you remember, almost half the country didn't vote in 2016. Considering all of the issues that we dealt with, considering all of the conflict and all of the dialogue that we had around very volatile and important issues, almost half the country didn't vote. And so I think now, in terms of the state of the conversation, there is a greater awareness of the importance of civics, something we don't even teach in schools anymore. But there's a greater awareness of the importance of civics.
And
I also
go ahead.
I also think that there's a I do think that there is a willingness on the part of the average voter to find ways to get more involved and active. If I always think about how after the Women's March, right after the election, I don't know if any party, and I even speak for my party, Democratic Party. I used to be the executive director of the state Democratic Party for a couple of years. I don't know if either party was actually prepared to take and to receive and to act upon all of the energy created by that march, or even the subsequent marches. I don't think we were really prepared to do that, but I do think that there are individuals not connected to party that are really trying to find ways to be active and engaged, and not just in presidential elections, which are important and sexy, but legislative elections and state legislative elections, which I always say that's where the rubber meets the road in public policy. If you think about something like education, it's 2% of the federal budget, but it's 25% of local and state budgets. So much policy is made on the local and state level in particular that we need to get people involved and engaged up and down the ballot. And that's something that I also think has come out of our recent elections, that folks are much more mindful of that, too.
I just want to ask you a question, because as you said, talking about engagement in the mm-hmm. process, it seemed to me that the 2016 election, for regardless of anything else you want to say about it, it certainly was covered. I mean, it certainly it went on a long time. There were any number of debates. The Republicans had 17 candidates at some point. It seemed to me that there were months and months and months of folks writing about politics, folks writing about the campaign, folks writing about the election. And the question I guess I have, and I don't even know if it's a question more than a comment, is even with all that exposure, the lack of involvement, is there something about the way politics is exposed? And is it something that there's any way to get back from the ledge of the kind of coverage of the campaigns that we now see?
I mean, that's an important question, because I actually think the effect of all of that, and even what you're seeing now, is that people are tuning out a bit. Right. They're not watching the news as often as they did. They're not watching certain types of news as often as they did. But I also think that for those that are, they are retreating to their silos. And that's I think, a big problem that we've had leading up to 2016, which is that because of social media, because of the ways in which our cable news is sort of produced, and I'm on cable news a lot, so I speak as part of the quote chattering class.
And you talk to folks who aren't part of your silo.
Correct.
You're a Fox News person sometimes.
That's right. I try to be fair and balanced.
Yeah, well, good for you.
But that's the thing. Like, because a lot of times they call it confirmation bias, right? Like we look for information and news that reinforces our own beliefs. And because we do that a lot, I think in many ways campaigns reflect that. They reflect that we, our existence and our news gathering and our information gathering within our silos. And interestingly enough, as bad as, let me say it from this point of view, as phenomenal as Barack Obama's campaign was in 2008, I actually think in many ways we may have learned the wrong lesson from it, which is He did two things. He created a phenomenal movement around his candidacy, and he also used analytics as an important tool in that candidacy. I think in many ways we relied too much on analytics and didn't focus enough on building the movement, because that movement would include organized labor in a way that I think would remind people how important organized labor was to creating jobs. And even if you consider what was done in New York City for about 20 to 30 years, 50,000 units of housing, you know, when we talk about affordable housing. I mean, we would remind voters of the importance of that. We would talk about how we could grow our economy using the immigrant community, which has been doing that for decades, right, helping to grow and progress our economy. So I think we stopped having those kinds of broader conversations. And I give you an interesting caveat that when I travel the state of New York, and if you go upstate New York, once you leave Rockland County, a lot of upstate New York can look like other parts of the country, Iowa, Kansas, in terms of the farmland. And I talk to farmers upstate New York. These are individuals who may be Democrats or may be Republicans, but also rely on immigrant labor to help their farm industry. So they have a vested interest in this. But I think if we focus more on the silos and didn't spend enough time having like real conversations with people about how to impact their lives day to day basis, I think that's part of why people started to tune out, and I think we got the result that we got. Keith Ellison, the member of Congress, who's also the deputy chair of the DNC, made this comment at a forum that I spoke at, and it always stuck with me. And it said, you know, the Democratic Party could be a party of social and economic justice. And I said, you know what? If we had that message and we talked more about that, I think that's a recipe for victory from a Democratic perspective. But broadly, I do think that still needs to happen. We have to have a broader conversation about how we just improve people's lives.
We're talking with Basil Smichel Jr. He is a distinguished lecturer of politics and public policy at the CUNY Murphy Institute. And we've got 3 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we had the conversation about what has happened as a result. We're taping this on Thursday. It will air on Sunday. As we speak, the President of the United States had folks in from Parkland, Florida, who just experienced a terrible tragedy in their community, in one of their schools. And something has seemed to have happened in the last week as a result of that shooting, and a movement does seem to be forming. What's your impression? And again, we've got 2.5 minutes, so I just wanted to let you know that.
No problem. So there are a couple of very quick things. One, I am happy to see that these young people are on the move. I mean, they're pushing in ways that I think are really impressive. They're pushing our elected leaders to take action. I just, in my cynical way, don't believe that a lot of these electeds, like a Marco Rubio and others, are going to be moved at the end of the day by this. But in some ways, we can get around that. If you care about this issue, look at what happened in 2008 with Barack Obama. There were story after story after story that even if older folks were reluctant to go out and vote for him, it was a younger generation that took their parents and grandparents to the polls, which is something we had not necessarily seen before. If these young people can do that around this issue itself, it may not be enough to take back the House or to topple a Marco Rubio, but it may be enough to change legislative seats across the country, particularly in Florida, and then end up putting pressure on some of these other electeds to make a difference. Sadly, after the shooting in Sandy Hook, when those children were shot in Connecticut, and we still didn't do anything as a country to deal with this, I kind of lost hope. But these young people are giving me hope today.
Are you talking about, I just want to be clear on this as we enter the last minute of the conversation, are you talking about the gun issue itself, or are you talking about a change in the political structure? When you say
I'm talking about both. I think you cannot, in this environment, I don't think we can have a substantial change in how we deal with guns until you impact the political structure, because there's so many leaders that are so entrenched with the NRA They will not budge because they are afraid of losing their seat. But the truth is, if these young people can come together and actually alter the structure, even within states and cities, it would put pressure on everybody else to do something.
Basil Smigel, you are the Distinguished Lecturer of Political Politics and Public Policy at the CUNY Center of Murphy Institute, Democratic strategist. I knew this was going to be a smart conversation. I'm sorry we've only got 15 minutes, but you're coming back, brother.
Anytime. I'm happy to.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Joining us now is the just-retired Associate Director of DC 37's Municipal Employees Legal Services, Mr. Robert Martin. You're joining us by phone from Chicago, sir.
In the Chicago area, yes. Hello, Chris.
Welcome back to the show. Congratulations on your recent retirement. However, I suspect it means it's just going to make you available to do other things. You don't strike me as the kind of guy who sits back and relaxes.
That's right. I'm still into things, just no longer a paid employee.
Well, we wanted to talk. One of the things that's happening, and it seems as if it's happening because our current president is very much opposed to anything the previous president did. And there are a number of things that the previous president, Barack Obama, there are a number of things that he did that were very helpful for working people. And one of the things that's happened recently is as Trump goes around undoing things that the previous administration accomplished, one of those things is he's dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's role. And let's talk about that a little bit.
That's a fair and accurate statement. Like many things, as you say, that Trump is doing to affect the public and working people, low-income persons. Those things are mirrored in the consumer protection and the consumer finance world. So under the Obama administration, and it was the brainchild, I guess, of Senator Elizabeth Warren and Richard Cordray, who was the first director, the Obama administration created this agency called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, and its mission was to stand up for the consuming public, because there was really no organization that was dedicated with that mission in mind. And so what we're seeing now is that Trump has appointed an interim director, Mulvaney from South Carolina, who is out to do away with the CFPB, or at least to cut it way back. He once called it a sick, sad joke. And so this is the person that Trump has put in charge. And he's already done a number of things to pull back on what the CFPB is doing. He redefined their mission statement and said that the first and foremost, they were out to cut back on regulations. And then the most recent thing, and I think we want to talk a little bit about this today, is that Mulvaney has announced that the CFPB is going to pull back on and reconsider and ask for an additional comment period on the rule that under Cordray the CFPB had promulgated to regulate payday lending.
Now, this is an issue. Payday lending is an issue that I thought that we in New York State, at least, understood is just a catch-22 for working folks and folks who are struggling paycheck by paycheck. And I thought we had made considerable progress in undoing payday lending practices. What I'm hearing you say is that those days may be back, maybe not in New York State, but across the country.
Well, what's happening nationally could affect what we're doing in New York State. It's a broad, group of organizations and legislators and, DC 37, the unions have been involved. We've had great success in keeping those awful payday loans out of New York. Payday loans are a debt trap. And the idea is that you get a loan because you're getting a paycheck or a Social Security check. And it's a high interest rate loan and you get some money and you pay a pretty high fee. And you can't pay it off, but guess what? Next paycheck, they'll renew the loan, and you pay more high fees, et cetera, et cetera. It's a debt trap. In New York, we've kept them out because New York, like 15 other states where payday loans are illegal, has a usury rate limit. It's an interest rate limit, and in effect, it keeps out payday loans. The payday loan companies and the big banks, because they're behind lots of things that happen in this area, are always knocking on the door, and so the regulators and more legislators in New York are standing strong. And this year, we hope and think that we're better off than ever. We have some new young legislators in New York, and they're have put both feet in the fight. And DC 37 is committed to being part of the effort to keep out payday loans. So back to the national level for a moment, the payday loan rule that Director Cordray had promulgated, and he recently stepped down in the last month or two, and Mulvaney has taken over. But the payday loan rule that was promulgated would apply to the states where payday loans are in effect illegal, and that's are in effect legal. They can be made in those states. That's about 35 states. And it put in some strong protections. So there were some floor requirements that would cut down on the number of loans that that people could take out in an annual period. The CFPB can't regulate the interest rate, but they did other things so that it would limit or curb to a pretty good extent. The rule wasn't perfect, but it would curb the practice of the payday lenders being able to keep recycling people continually and forever into these loans that just eat into people's paycheck or their Social Security check. And so the rule would set up floor requirements that would, make those loans better. They're still bad, but would make them much better in the other 35 states. But now what's happened with the CFPB wants to delay the implementation of that rule, and it would also, if they succeed in that, it would have a spillover effect in states like New York, the 15 states we call them payday freelandia, where payday loans are illegal. It could have a spillover effect because if the federal rule is cut back, then it could affect what we do. Although in the short run, it's made our effort here stronger, and it's sort of kind of rallied the forces.
This seems to be so much about rigging the rules or changing the rules or futzing with the rules so that it's just harder for folks who are not making a lot of money to stay afloat. And this is kind of like the tax break that just the tax cut that just went into effect, where people are getting one-time bonuses of $1,000 and applauding that, as opposed to getting a real raise in the wages and a meaningful increase in their salaries. These one-time $1,000 things, these payday loans, which is, are presented as, we're helping people pay their bills, right? I mean, we will help you get your money, but we're going to take a VIG, right? That is going to be impossible for you to catch up on. That's
Chris. It's exactly the same thing. The whole deal, the charade about the tax cuts. They really are going to benefit rich people. The changes to the if they change the payday loan rule, guess who's going to benefit? People with money that are making money off working people. And one of the things that hit the headlines was, follow the money. So the figures, are out there for everyone to see about the contributions that the payday loan industry. In the banking industry, make to people in Congress, and the annual convention of the payday lending industry, that where hundreds of representatives of hundreds of businesses go, just coincidentally, will be taking place. I think it's coming up very soon at one of the big Trump resorts in Florida. And of course, the Trump people, denied there was a connection. They say, this convention was planned a year or two ago. The bigger picture, of course, is that what's going on in Washington now is that, everything is tied to business, and businesses are making money, as you say, at the expense of working people.
We're talking with the former associate director of DC 37's Municipal Employees Legal Services, Robert Martin. We just have about a minute left, Bob. So with these payday lending practices sort of revived or possibly revived, what does that mean in terms of what we're going to be doing to fight this?
Well, DC 37 is part of an international union that asked me, and so, which is in turn part of the AFL, and all the labor interests are fighting every day, as people know, I think, in Washington to hold off what the administration can do to people. And in New York, as I mentioned, we have a strong fight back here. We want to fight, predatory loans, bad loans, and in addition, promote sound and fair financial institution practices in communities. And I'll mention one thing. There are small community.
We got about 30 seconds left.
Small community credit unions in New York that really make good and safe loans to people, called community development financial institutions. And there's a program in New York to promote those kinds of institutions because they provide a good alternative to bad loans.
And DC 37 members who need help should always feel free to contact the Municipal Employees Legal Services at DC 37, and you can check that out on the website, www.
And the number is 212-815-1111.
And the website is www.dc37.net. Robert Martin, thank you for joining us, and you will be back. I am going to bring you back on a regular basis to be smart on the radio.
Anytime. Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. We are out of time. One announcement before we go. DC 37 concludes its month-long celebration of Black History Month with our grand finale featuring the Motown Story. That's Wednesday, February 28th at 4 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For tickets and more information, call 212-815-1060. I want to thank my guests, Basil Smichael Jr. and Rob Martin, for joining us this evening. As always, the engineer is Andrea Minocchio. The producer is Rudy Orozco. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.